Welcome to the teaching ministry of North Coast Church at Vista, California. We invite you to please open your Bibles as we join Pastor Chris Brown for today's message.
It had been so long. Where do we even start? It's good to see you again. How have you been? Just doesn't cut it. Realize, for the older one, he thought this moment would never come. It was impossible. No one comes back from the dead. And as far as he knew, he was dead. For the younger one, the last time he saw his father, he was 17. He's now 39. Just the lifespan itself in 22 years, how do you catch up on? But let alone what you've gone through. Do you even start with... You know, it wasn't my fault. My brother sold me into slavery. I didn't want to go. Do you start with, well, here's what happened when I was a slave. And then here's what happened in prison. Yes, prison. I didn't do the rape, but I was accused of it. And there wasn't a trial. How do you go from prison to being vice president of the country? Dad, look who I am. How do you do that? How do you do 22 years? They've had now weeks, if not months, to think about this reunion. Father gets to meet long-lost son who he thought was dead. Son at 17 thought he'd never see family again, let alone be in a place to rescue them. And regardless of what you had planned, regardless of how much you had to catch up on, as we're going to find today, we get to see the reunion. And oddly enough, there's not a lot of words said. There's just a lot of tears and an embrace that lasts forever. I mean, can you imagine the scene in the story? At 17, you had dreams. At 17, you felt like God had his hand on your life and you were about to do something. But at 17, you didn't know how to handle those dreams. They came off incredibly arrogant and braggadocious to your brothers. At 17, you had siblings who were incredibly jealous of you. And some of us have been in that situation. So no matter how it would have been presented, they would have hated you anyway. At 17, older brothers had enough, sold you into slavery, took your coat of many colors, that one that Dad put on you, just to let all the brothers know, I got a bunch of boys, this one's my favorite, he's off limits, and we'll show you what happens to an off-limit coat. And they cut it up and they dip it in blood. For Dad, 22 years seems like yesterday. For Dad, he has to go back to that moment countless times. When your 10 sons brought in that coat that was ripped and shredded and dipped in blood and said, Dad, it looks like Joey's. One of the wild animals must have gotten to him. For a dad having to relive that nightmare, a dad who's supposed to protect, a dad who's supposed to be there, realizing your teenage boy, your favorite, was brutally, savagely killed, and you weren't there to help, you weren't there to protect. How many hours was he left laying there before he finally succumbed to his injuries? Oh, I pray to God it was a quick death. Should a parent ever pray to God that a child had a quick death? And for Dad, 22 years, that moment, that realization that his favorite son was attacked and killed is still so alive in his memory. It's plagued him, as we've seen. For a son thinking my life's over, I'm sold into slavery and then in prison. For a son thinking that, man, how can I ever get out of this mess? To now be second in command of the greatest empire in the known world, second only to Pharaoh himself over Egypt. And to hear that that dad that you thought you'd never see again is still alive and on his way. Oh, the thoughts that must surround the scene we're about to see. And Joseph, I'm sure, has kept lookouts on the Goshen border. When you see him coming, tell me. I want to run out to meet him. There's no mistake in the crew. There's going to be about 140, 150 in all. They're going to look like a bunch of rednecks, hicks from the hillbilly country. That's where they're coming from. They won't look like anything we have in Egypt. They won't smell like anything we have in Egypt. They're going to come in with NASCAR stickers and flags on the wagons we gave them. And they're going to be a little backwards. That's my family. We're going to keep them outside the city. And word comes to second in command, I'm sure, on bended knee. Sir, your family's coming in the distance. Oh, he runs to his chariot. It's been gassed up and waiting for days. And he flies through the city. When you're second in command, you don't have to obey traffic laws. You don't care who sees you speeding. And it's a full-on gallop. It's a stride all the way out. And we get to catch the scene. To follow this story and maybe the happily ever after ending that we're going to see, I want to challenge you with some of this. And so if you got a Bible, open it to the book of Genesis. We're going to be in chapter 46, very first book of the Bible, toward the very back, Genesis chapter 46. And in Genesis 46, we have this long-awaited meeting between Joseph and his dad Jacob, who also goes by Israel. A dad that thought his youngest son was dead. A son that thought he'd never see his father again. And what happens to the rest of the family? Where to start? Somewhere, well, Larry conveniently left off in front of 12 verses of nothing but names. I'm not going to read nothing but names. They're there for a reason. They're important. I think if nothing else, it's just God's way of showing, hey, there's 70 men counted in this. If nothing else, it's maybe this sneak peek of God saying, think of something beyond yourself. My life's just not about who I impact, but Amy and I are raising three small humans in such a way where one day there's going to be two godly women who are going to be fit for hopefully godly boys, maybe some of yours. That's scary. I watch your boys running around. I'm like, God, not that one. Not that one. But godly women in such a way that they hopefully marry men that love Jesus, want to work hard, want to make an impact to raise their own family. We're raising a son, hopefully be a godly man that knows his job is to protect on this earth. His job's to live into others. At eight, that's really hard to get into his head, but we're dripping it in. Because hopefully one of you is raising a godly woman who needs a godly guy. See, it's not just about us. We're looking at this next generation going, what do these three families do in the world around us? And if all of them have kids like we have kids, what does that generation do? And somewhere within 100 years, it's conceivable that the Brown family's got 200 of us walking around impacting the world. Maybe that's why these lists are here. To show one guy that didn't look like he had much going for him, but raised boys and tried his best to say, here's how you walk with God. And now this generation, 70 men in all, is about to go to Egypt. And in the sequel, in the book of Exodus, it'll be 400 years. But when this group comes out of Egypt, they will be a nation of about 2 million strong. Oh, North Coast. To really understand, all 9,000 of us here today, it's not just what we do, but what if? What if? 200 years from now, we all live the type of lives where in our families and our homes and our relationships, we impact others. Where the next generation and the next generation carries that on. Oh, what an impact that could be for North County, San Diego, and the West Coast. Maybe that's why there's a list of names. Maybe Larry just didn't want to read them and he left them with me. So for those of you that go, man, the last 4 weeks of Larry has been amazing. There's been depth. There's been insight. We haven't had to put up with all the little stories. I'm back. I'm sorry. For others of you that go, man, the last 4 weeks we've had Larry, I'm sorry. But we're going to get started in verse 26. That was a good one. Verse 26. Now all those who went down to Egypt with Jacob, those were his direct descendants, not counting his sons' wives, numbered 66 persons. With the two sons who had been born to Joseph in Egypt, the members of Jacob's family, which went to Egypt, were 70 in all. Now women, I know all of a sudden you go, they only count the man? This Bible's so sexist. And now get this. This Bible gives more value to women than any other book in antiquity. This Bible is the very reason we have the equality of women today. This Bible brought strength, empowerment, rights to women like we're never seen before in the ancient world. And may I remind you, they have a way of counting clans, tribes, families, nations by men. That's the way the world was back then. But may I remind you, 10 chapters ago, a woman gets raped in the town. And God's people destroy every man in that town. For raping an innocent woman. That was the value. That was the value put on the sanctity of women in that day and age in the Bible. A woman gets raped in our town today. Well, what else is new? Yeah, let's be careful when we read passages like this and go, well, the Bible didn't value women. Oh, the Bible values women. The way of counting was men. They didn't count the women. They didn't count the children. But 70 men in all now head down to Egypt. And now Jacob sent Judah in verse 28 ahead of him to Joseph to get directions for Goshen. And when they arrived in the region of Goshen, Joseph had his chariot made ready. And he went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And as soon as Joseph appeared before him, he threw his arms around his father. He wept for a long time. Israel said to Joseph, now I am ready to die since I have seen for myself that you are still alive. Oh, what a difference. Now I am ready to die, since I've seen for myself that you are still alive. Four chapters ago in 42:36, Jacob, he'll go by Israel or Jacob, his cry was, everything is against me. I have no life or reason to live. And four chapters later, his heart is so filled with joy and happiness that he goes, there's no room left for anything else. Today's a good day to die. How do you get there? How do you get from a place where right now for North Coast, maybe you're watching a Carlsbad Fabric in Kailua, many of the places and the bases around the world today where men and women are serving. How do you get to a place where you go, everything's against me. There's no hope in my life. It just seems like there's nothing going on. I'd like to kill myself. To four chapters later going, this is so great. My heart's so full. I could die today and be happy. How do you get there? That's what I want to challenge you with today. You see, for Jacob, there was no way to get there. The reason for his hurt and pain was death of his son. You don't bring that back to life. And yet what I love about the Bible is this is a God that seems to delight in doing the impossible, the improbable, the unexplainable in the lives of those that follow him in such a way where you can be sitting here today and say, everything's against us. We're going to die. There's no hope in my life. No use to go on. To four chapters later with a grin on your face, just going, man, this is so good. I got room for no more joy. I always found that an odd statement. Today's a good day to die. No, you got your son back. Today's a good day to live. My father-in-law is Jewish. He's Messianic Jew. He believes in the Messiah and Christ. And so Amy grew up in a Messianic Jewish home. And he does the exact same saying. He's 86 years old. We'll pick him up. We'll take him out. Maybe it's a day of hanging out at our house or dinner. Or we'll go out to eat. The kids will be playing. He'll just sit there and watch him run around being crazy. On the way home, he'll be looking out the window and he'll just say, today's a good day to die. And I always thought to myself, well, don't debate him. He's 86. But no, today's a good day to live. I tell you, a good day to die is when I'm 600 emails behind. I got a stack of complaints. I got bills that have to be paid. People are angry. I'm like, man, this is a good day to die. Leave this for somebody else. Not him. He picks the best days and goes, today's a good day to die. Maybe it's an old Hebrew Jewish saying. The heart is so full. It's like, I can't take any more joy. Today's a good day to die. And regardless of how'd you get here? What'd you do? What do you mean you're vice president? I thought you were dead. I thought it's just hug. It's just an embrace. And it's dad in the weeping. Life's full. Four chapters ago, life was empty and everything was against him. And now life is full. But Joseph realizes he's got to set up the family. Verse 31. So Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I'm going to go up and speak to Pharaoh and I'm going to say to him, my brothers and my father's household who are living in the land of Canaan have come to me. Now the men are shepherds. They tend livestock and they brought along their flocks and herds and everything they own. And when Pharaoh calls you in and asks, what's your occupation? You should answer, your servants have tended livestock from our boyhood on, just as our father did. Then you will be allowed to settle in the region of Goshen. For all the shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians. Now Joseph went and told Pharaoh, my father and brothers are here with their flocks and herds and everything they own. They've come from the land of Canaan. They're now in Goshen. He chose five of his brothers and presented them before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh asked the brothers, what's your occupation? Well, your servants are shepherds, they replied to Pharaoh, just as our fathers were. Now they also said to him, we've come to live here a while. Circle, highlight, underline. We're just here until the famine. Maybe 300-400 years. Oh, they thought this was temporary. They had no idea that God was going to use Egypt as an incubator for his nation. You see, at this point in time, if you looked on Google Maps, you wouldn't find the nation of Israel. Israel was a dude. You don't name a nation after a dude. Israel's walking around with a bunch of podunk-hick sons who've seemed to fly off the handle at any given moment. Not a lot going for them. They're a very small tribe, if you will, in that culture. And in famine, they're about to be wiped out. If they survive the famine, they're so small. How do they defend themselves against the warring nations around them? See, God will use Egypt, a place where Egypt doesn't want anything to do with shepherds and Hebrews, where the Hebrews will stick to their own tribe and clan and not intermerge with the Egyptians. And God will use Egypt, that great power, as an incubator for his people. So they will go in with the mount of 70 men. 400 years from now, the sequel, Exodus, they will march out about 2 million strong. They thought it was temporary. And sometimes in our Egypts, we hope and pray they're just temporary. And yet God's like, no, I want you here for a reason. You wouldn't survive outside of Egypt right now. This is for your good. You may think it's just for a while. You will not even get this in your generation. You will not even get this in the next generation. But trust me, today, if you Google map, you type in Israel, you'll see the little outline. Oh, there's so much dispute still around that piece of land today. It's named after this guy and these 70. And a birthplace will be in Egypt. We just want to be here a while because the famine's severe in Canaan. Your servants' flocks have no pasture. So now, please, let your servants settle in Goshen. I love the way Joseph does this. He knows. He's never asked Pharaoh for anything. Remember, he had dreams. Pharaoh had dreams from God, and no one can interpret them. Joseph is the only one in the land that walks with God. Therefore, Joseph can interpret Pharaoh's dreams. We hit this now about, what, 7 chapters ago? And Joseph told Pharaoh, you're going to have 7 years of famine. In fact, it's the type of famine that's just going to bring your entire empire to your knees. But it will be followed by 7 years of great abundance. That's what God says. Now Joseph used his own smarts, his own ability, his administration gifts, his business sense. If I was you, here's what I'd do. I would store up and tax your people 20%. Keep all that for 7 years. At the end of that, you'll have enough to keep your nation going. In fact, we'll find out next year. At the end of that, you'll end up owning everyone's land and everyone's cattle. This is going to be a great deal for you, Pharaoh. Pharaoh's been so impressed with this guy. Made him second in command. And he's never asked for a favor. And now Joseph has to go before him and realize, I got a family of 70 men. If you have another, why is that going to send 140 kids, maybe 160, 180? I got to get my family land. And your people don't like my people. Okay, guys, gather up. I know 22 years ago you sold me as a slave. I'm vice president now. Don't screw this one up for me. Here's exactly what you say. Here's exactly what you do. You're not used to standing in front of Pharaoh. I am. Okay, come with me. Actually, you and you stay here. You in the sweatpants and the Bud Light t-shirt with the sleeves cut off. Stay here. Guys, let's go. Actually, Reuben, can you get rid of the dip? You can't get rid of the dip. Reuben, you stay here. Come on, guys, let's go. By the time he's done, he only takes 5. Only has 5 that he can present before Pharaoh. He's all, the rest of you, hide behind the wagons. Okay, now I'm going to buy some new clothes for you guys. Keep your mouth shut. And they're in front of Pharaoh. They did exactly as they were told. And Pharaoh has his response and said to Joseph in verse 5, your father and your brothers have come to you, and the land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best part of the land. Let them live in Goshen. And if you know of any among them with special ability, put them in charge of my own livestock. Let me just talk a little business sense right here. Did you catch that? Pharaoh has been so impressed with Joseph that he goes, look, you've never asked for anything. It's yours. Find the best of land. What are they? A bunch of ranchers, farmers? Put them out in Goshen, away from the big city. That's great pasture land. Joseph, come here. Are there any like you? Do any of them have the gifts and abilities like you have? If they do, put them in charge of everything I have. Forget about other people's wealth. Put them in charge of my stuff. Because I've seen what you've done with my stuff. Did you catch that? Oh, it's in your food for thought this week, but did you catch that? You want a motto to live by? You're an employee and you want a standard to set for yourself? There it is. May you serve your boss, your company, in such a way where they call you in and say, is there any others like you? Oh, I long for the day. We have to set up a separate hotline phone at North Coast just because of the amount of businesses across North County and Orange County that are calling in going, hey, do you have any other employees looking for work? Because we have one of yours in the office. We could use about a dozen more of that. And you're going, Chris, you don't understand the company and the jerk that I work for. Did you get this? He's working for Egypt. Okay? He's working for the government of Egypt. His boss thinks he's God. And you're like, my boss thinks he's God too. No, he doesn't have an own religion after him. His boss literally thinks he's Ra, the sun god. The Pharaoh of Egypt is seen as a god. People bow, worship, incense to him. This is who Joseph is working for and has been doing it in such a way where the self-made God comes to him and goes, is there anyone else like you? For those of you that are supervisors, managers, owners, entrepreneurs, for those of you that oversee others, oh, may you lead in such a way where your staff says, I hope I work here for the rest of my life. But if I don't, I hope I get to work for another Christian. I've never had a boss like that. I've never had a manager like that. I've never had a supervisor serve their staff like that. If that's what people that go to North Coast are like, I always want to work for someone from North Coast. Oh, I love that little scene. There's verses in your food for thought this week if you want to follow along and just look at that more. But I thought, what a great insight. If there's any like you, put him in charge of all my stuff. Well, then Joseph brought his father Jacob in and presented him before Pharaoh. After Jacob blessed Pharaoh, Pharaoh asked him, how old are you? I think this is going to be very funny in just a second. Jacob said to Pharaoh, man, the years of my pilgrimage are 130, but my years have been few and difficult. They do not equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. Catch the scene. Joseph picks five of his brothers, says, hey, I want you to meet these guys. Shut up. Don't say much. Get the dip out. Take the ball caps off. This is Pharaoh. Now get back out in the field. He says, oh, Pharaoh, I want you to meet my pop. Jacob comes walking in. And twice it says, Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Catch that scene. Jacob's a nobody. Jacob doesn't have anything. Jacob has brought his family here to beg for food because they're starving to death. Jacob is a poor podunk farmer from the hill country. Jacob doesn't have a great title. Right now you're like, oh, that's the father nation. He's from Abraham, Isaac. No, no, no. He doesn't have any of that right now. The Bible is not being written chapter by chapter. Pharaoh's not like, are you the Jacob of chapter 38 and 39? It's not there. He's like, Israel, do you have a nation named after you? And he's like, I got a bunch of wagons with guys who weren't fit to see you. Pharaoh is the most powerful man in the world. Egypt is the most powerful nation in the world. Pharaoh thinks he's God. He has an entire nation that worships him at God. Who blesses who? Jacob blesses Pharaoh. I don't know how it happened. I don't know what he did. I wish we had more there. I wonder if he just walked up to him and realized, wow, that's what the most powerful man in the world looks like. You need Jesus. I got Jesus. Can I pray for you? Looks like the stress of the famine has gotten to you a little bit. Is there something I could pray for you for? I wonder if the old wrinkly dude had it in him just to walk up and just touch him and just go, can I pray for you? When's the last time anyone prayed for God? He thinks he's God. Oh, he blesses him. I think it so touches Pharaoh that he looks and realizes, dude, how old are you? It's set as a question. I think the dude looks like death. No, 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 no. This isn't a joke on age. I think it's in the text. Dude, you look really bad. And he's got to answer, my years are 130. They haven't really been that much, but man, they've been tough on me. I realize I'm 130 going on like 195. And I think that's what Pharaoh's saying. Your son's 39. I thought you'd be in your 60s, you know, some gray silver hair, a wise dude. You had a son like that. Man, bet you're in fit, good shape for 60. And then Yoda comes walking in on a stick. I think it's there. I think Pharaoh's like, hey, thanks for the prayer. Should you be alive? And Jacob realizes he doesn't look good. He goes, I'm only 130, which isn't that old in that day and age. He goes, I'm only 130, but man, they've been tough years. Oh, how much is wrapped up there? If you've been here over the last few months, we've walked it. It's almost as if Jacob is saying, you know what? I came out of the womb fighting with my brother Esau. I came out holding his heel. Remember the story? It was a tough upbringing. Mom had me as a favorite. Dad loved my reddish brother, furry dude, a hunter. I tricked my old man when he got blind, got the birthright. But because of that, I was told I had to leave home for decades. I grew up a nobody. I had to travel and find a crooked uncle named Laban and work for him. The guy was a scoundrel, man. He cheated me every chance he could get. It was later in life, around my 50s or 60s, I fell in love. Her name was Rachel. But the wedding night, they switched sisters on me. They made me marry Leah, the one that was weak on the eyes. biblical. Just biblical. Staying true to the text. He said, I had to work twice as long for her and then get Rachel. Then there was a battle about who could have kids. Leah seemed to have a lot of kids. Rachel couldn't produce. And so they gave me their maidservant so they could kind of have surrogate moms and raise them. He goes, do you realize how tough it is to live in a home with two wives? Now I've got four women that all lay claim to me. Four women have had these boys. Finally, Rachel gave birth and he was my favorite. I thought in my retirement years, I could stay home a little while. It was me and Joey loved that kid until the day they brought in a coat with blood. And I realized I wasn't there when he died. The famine's hit. It's taken everything we had. I've had a long journey. I look like I'm about 195. I'm 130. Oh, it's been a tough road. Can I bless you? Somewhere in this journey, I found a God that doesn't let me go, even though I've let him go. Can I bless you? I think that's what's wrapped up in that statement. It's just a guess. I don't know why else the Bible has the age mentioned and him trying to clarify. I'm just 130, but it's been a tough road. Have you been there? I know we want heaven now. I know I want God's blessings now. I know I don't want to go through my Egypt. There is times God says, you know what happened? You found character and you found your God. And you would have never found God without the struggles. And God says, at the end of your life, I need you. And if I need to take you through struggles to find me, I'll do it because I don't want to lose you forever. And the problem with an easy road is you're going to make it about yourself. You're going to find out that you can do it. You can own it. And you won't have a relationship with me. And then the moment you die, I lose you forever. So it's been 130 years and they've been tough years. But buddy, I have you. Oh, I have you. I think that's wrapped up there. Just my thoughts. And Joseph settled his father and his brothers in Egypt, gave them property in the best part of the land, the district of Ramesses, as Pharaoh directed. There was no district of Ramesses. And you go, well, the Bible's wrong again. No, the district of Ramesses won't be built for 400 years. Moses is writing this book to those he's let out. He go, guys, you want to know where Goshen is? In Exodus chapter 1, the slaves were ordered to build storehouses for Ramesses outside the city. He goes, we built the towers where 400 years ago our forefathers camped. Just a little added note to the slaves that are following. As they're all sitting and hearing the story about what God did, about how we took them into Egypt and about now how they're out, I think it's Moses' way of just saying, we built this. This is the story of our people. And Joseph also provided his father and his brothers and all of his father's household with food according to the number of their children. And they all lived happily ever after. It's like the extreme home makeover version. All 70 of them get new houses, new furniture, new appliances, Maytag washers, flat screens. They all get Escalades. Remember the carts that he sent out for their stuff? And they walk in and go, seriously, we have the best of Egypt and the Egypt is the best of the world. And we sold our brother into slavery. We felt guilty for 22 years. Dad thought he lost him and this is what we get. Oh, don't we want an ending like that? Don't we all want our own little happily ever after? And that's what hit me when I got done reading this. As much as I want to go on with the rest of the story, we're going to have to wait till next week. Because I thought, we've only got about 3, maybe 4 weeks left in the book of Genesis. And I don't know about you, but I've loved it. There are stories I've known before, names I've heard before. The God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, yeah. But to go back and walk with them, to go inside their tents, to go into Egypt and to see it, man, I've learned so much from this. But I think the danger is, if we don't call a timeout today, and really talk about what's this have to do with us, we're going to leave the book of Genesis and we're going to fall into a fallacy that happens with a lot of Christians. It happened with the nation of Israel because this is the way it should be. A nobody like Abraham from the backwoods of Babylon, an idol worshiping family, gets to be the father of God's people. That's the way it should be. A guy like Jacob with a tough life at the end goes, man, I'm so happy I could die. That's the way it should be. If right now you feel like you're in a slave position or in prison, you feel like, when do I get to be vice president of the nation? That's the way it should be. It's the way the Sunday school teachers taught it to me. where I'd sit there at the age of six and they'd say, boys and girls, watch, watch, listen, listen. And we all look up. And every story was different, but every story ended the same. If you ever have to go up against a Goliath, even though you're just a little guy, all you have to do is pray and God will make you win. And I'm like, check that. If you ever have to be put into a fiery furnace like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you just pray to God and the fire won't burn you. House catch on fire, pray to God. Check that. If you ever have to spend the night with hungry lions like Daniel, just pray to God and the lions won't bite. If you ever get swallowed by a great fish for 3 days, you can still come back to life like Jonah. Just pray to God. Check that. And at six, I love the stories. At six, everything ended like this. At six, it's like, okay, when's my happily ever after? When does God come through? That seems to be the entire, all the stories of the Bible. By 16, I realized life doesn't work that way. By 26, a lot of us have just thrown in the towel and said, forget it. You know the number one reason why most people don't like Christianity? They've tried it. And it doesn't work. Fire kills, cancer kills, lions of this world destroy, and the Goliaths win. They're great for six-year-olds. They keep the attention in Sunday school. But when's your prison end? When's your slavery going to be done? Have you been there? And I just realized, man, we got to figure out how to make his story our story. How do we get on this? And to do this, we're not even going to come back here. I want you to turn to the right to 1 Samuel 4. We're going to take a time out in our study. And I want to tell you the danger that Genesis is going to do. 1 Samuel, it's to the right, about five more books. You're going to pass Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, 1 Samuel. It's followed by 2 Samuel. So they're big books. A little bit to the right, you can find 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 Samuel 4. Yeah, you'll probably skip Ruth. It's a little chick flick tucked in there. You'll never see her. Great story. Go online and rent it from us. It's free. We did that a couple of summers ago. It was awesome. 1 Samuel chapter 4. You see, Israel told these stories. Moses let Israel know, here's how God works, here's what he does. So Israel followed the Sunday school model. When we get into problems, when we get into trouble, you call on God and God's going to come through and fix things. And I realized, North Coast, we just wrapped up the book of Genesis. We just got a couple weeks left. And if you're expecting God to fix your situation, if you're expecting life to turn out happily ever after, because that's what we've been reading, some of us may be in for a rude awakening. Israel fell into that problem. The nation, not the guy. In 1 Samuel chapter 4. Now Samuel's word came to all of Israel, and the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. The Israelites camped at Ebenezer, the Philistines at Aphek, and the Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel. As the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. And when the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, why? Why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines? And someone comes up with the answer. Someone's been to Sunday school. Let us bring the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from the city Shiloh so that it may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies. Well, the people sent men to Shiloh. They brought back the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Ark of the Lord's Covenant came into camp, all of Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. They got what you and I have been taught for the last, I don't know, months that we've been in the book of Genesis. When you get to a problem, when you get to a situation, you call on God, God will come through and God will help you. Some of our lives right now are so messed up and so hurting, and we're right now in a place of calling out to God, going, God, when are you going to break my bondage? God, when are you going to fix my life? God, if that's what you did with Joseph, Pastor Chris always says, the way God dealt with people is the way God deals with people. Thanks, Edge, we're going to do this again. The way God dealt with people is the way God deals with people. Now, life helped you out, so you got it. But here's where it's at. So when's mine? If that's what God did with Joseph, with Abraham, when's he fixed my life? I'm telling him I need it fixed. Israel did it. They go to battle against their sworn enemies. The Philistines come down. Israel comes down. They meet in the middle of the valley where the little creek flows and the butterflies flutter and rabbits frolic, and it's a massive humanity. It's hand to hand, fist to fist, weapon to weapon, shield to shield. And at the end of day one, 4,000 of God's people are left face down in the mud and muck of the battlefield. And the camera of Scripture, the lens, takes us inside the tent of the generals of Israel. And they're all sitting around going, God, why? Have you ever asked that? Sometimes the most honest prayer you can ever have with God is, God, why do you hate me? Why'd you bring defeat on me? Can I just call a timeout in the master plan of life right now and remind you, I'm on your side? I'm one of the good guys here? I'm a child of God? Why is the world kicking my butt? Why are we getting beat down right now? And someone's been to Sunday school and someone brings up, let's get the ark. Remember that? Little 3-foot box by about 2.5 feet. It's covered in gold. Two little angels. The very sign, symbol of God's presence. The box. They got the box. Inside the box are three things. Remember what three things? Inside the box are the 10 commandments. Ooh, God's contract. Not a copy of the 10 commandments. Not some crochet that some woman did and put in there. The 10 commandments. God saying, I am God. You'll be my people. Here's my covenant with you. Put that in the box. Inside the box is Aaron's cane, his old petrified walking stick. At a time where they needed God's help and direction and said, God, is this what we're supposed to do or not? God said, look, I'll even show you a sign. Leave your walking stick outside your tent. And the next morning when they looked at it, it had sprung vines and flowers and it budded. And they're like, oh, that's a cane. That's good. Put it in the box. Third thing in the box. That's right. A Tupperware full of Pop-Tarts is in the box. The Old Testament word for it is manna, but it's the exact same thing. When your people were starving, when you cried out for God for food, when you're wandering in the wilderness, once you left Egypt, God said, wake up tomorrow morning, and as far as you can see, there'll be Pop-Tarts. Only get enough for today. Don't try to keep any overnight. They'll spoil. They expire in 20 hours. Not like today's Pop-Tart that expires in 2,000 years, but they're like, they expire in 20 hours. I want you every day to realize I will once again come through for you. Live for me daily. By the way, put some in Tupperware and put them in the box. It'll be a reminder to your people. This box led you across the Jordan River that made it split at flood stage. This box went to the walls of Jericho when you had to come to the Holy Land. And you did a parade with the box and blew horns and the walls came down. They get the battle, they get beat down, and they realize we got to get back to the things of God that work. Get the box. Now, there's such a shout, even though they've lost 4,000 men, fathers, uncles, nephews, sons, grandfathers that day. There's such a shout in the camp in the wee hours of the morning that it echoes across the valley and wakes up their enemies. And the second lens of Scripture takes us inside that. And it says, hearing the uproar, the Philistines ask, well, what's all the shouting in the Hebrew camp? And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come into camp, the Philistines were afraid. A God has come into camp, they said. We're in trouble, eh? Nothing like this has ever happened before. Woe to us. I always wondered how that's translated in the Philistine language. They just dropped the W bomb right there. We are seriously woed right now. All of you guys are about to be woed. Get out of here. Who's going to deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck down the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the desert. And just when I think there won't be a battle, just when they're rolling up their bedding, just when they're getting their armor together, just when they're about to leave. And I don't know about you, but I want justice in this world. I want God to come through and bring some answers that I can see. And just when I think they won't fight because they're scared to death of the box. Now, they have really bad theology or a Bible understanding. They say these gods, small g, plural, they don't even know the God of Israel. They don't know Yahweh. They don't know the one true God. They just go, gods is this. But they know the power of the box. Remember Indiana Jones, when you lift the lid, like people melt? Ooh, they've seen the movie. And they're like, we're not fighting the box. And just when I think there won't be a day two battle, he comes riding across their lines. Half of his face is painted blue, the other half white. His hair is back in a ponytail. Philistine Wallace, they call him. And he gives this speech in verse 9. Be strong, Philistines. Be men. Or you will be subject to the Hebrews, as they have been subject to you. Be men and fight. And they're all, ha! Ah! And I'm like, yeah, great speech, wrong side. This is gotta be God. Because the Christians, the followers of God, know what I've been taught. If you get into a situation or a problem in life, you get God, you put him in it, and day two is going to be different than day one. It's the way the Bible works. And he talks them into fighting. So the Philistines fight. And the Israelites, God's people, were defeated. And every man fled to his tent. This time the slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured. And Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. And at the end of the battle on day two, The camera does this aerial of the valley. It's now 30,000 of God's people laying face down in the dirt and mud. The creek is running a dark crimson red. And at the bottom of the battlefield, the two high priest's sons, next in line to be high priest, are laying with their hands outstretched, not quite touching. And as the camera pans up, your enemies are high-fiving each other. And they're carrying a little gold box as a souvenir back home. And credits start rolling up the screen. And I want my money back. Have you been there? You ever got to a place in the Christian life where you just want your money back? Hey, don't get me wrong. As a six-year-old, I love the stories. But how well have they played out for you? And you go, well, Chris, it's not the end of the chapter. I'm sure things get better. No, things get worse. Word comes to Eli, your high priest, that they lost the box and his sons, and he dies that day, has a stroke. Word comes to Phinehas, his wife, next in line to be high priest. She's pregnant. She hears the news that her husband died and they stole the box. She goes into premature labor. They try their best to come around her. They can't save the mom, but they save the baby boy. But since the baby boy lost his mom in childbirth, his dad died on the battlefield, and his grandfather, your high priest, died that day. There's no one to name him. So the townspeople named the baby Ichabod, which means the glory of God has just left us. So yes, there's more to the story. And I still want my money back. What happened? They did everything I was told to do. You go through life, you come to a problem, what do? You remember you have God. Come here, God, get it. Good God, oh, good problem. I got God back in the box. And I go through life and I come across a financial situation. Maybe we're about to lose the house, or maybe we have to declare bankruptcy, or maybe it's been a long time since you've had a job and you can't find it. What do? You call God. Come here, God, get it. Good. Oh, good God, back in the box. I come through life and there's a relationship issue. Maybe lack of relationship, or the person that you're still in a relationship with hasn't changed. And what do? You get God. Come here, God, get it. Fix it. Oh, good God, back in the box. I know you're sitting there going, Chris, at North Coast, we've never treated God like a big dog before. That's the point. It's religion. And it's not going to help you a bit. In fact, let me tell you why religion won't help us at all. In your note sheet, I want you to write this down. And some of you are like, finally, I can write something. You should have been taking notes all along. Why religion won't help us. I want you to beware. Crying out to God in faith can result in frustration and resentment. You heard that right. Crying out to God in faith can result in frustration and resentment. I did the outline this week on Thursday. It goes to our proof checkers, and they came back to me and said, I think you got the statement wrong. And I'm like, why? They're like, this doesn't sound right to us, that if you cry out to God in faith, it's going to result in frustration and resentment. I'm like, no, that's right. They're like, no, you should read it again. And I read it again. If you cry out to God in faith, it can result in frustration and resentment. I'm like, no, that's what I want to say. They're like, that doesn't sound right. I'm like, oh, it doesn't, but it's biblical. It's biblical. Oh, Israel cried out to God. Let's get the box. Let's get God. They had so much faith, they woke up their enemies. So much faith that the ground shook. And God said, oh, this one's going to hurt you. I'm not jumping when you say jump. Oh, I want you to hear with your own ears. Maybe if you want to see it with your own eyes, Proverbs chapter 1. I'm going to promise you, you will not like these verses. If you like to find Proverbs, in the middle of your Bible is Psalms. It's 150 chapters. So if you flip in the middle, you cannot miss Psalms. It starts with a P. P Psalm, 150 chapters. The very next one is Proverbs 1, 22. Now I want to be honest with you. I want to make this very clear for those of you that are about to write cards. I did not write the book of Proverbs. Okay? So when you don't like this, your comment card goes, Dear God, I can't believe you said that. Okay? And we'll turn it into him, but I ain't reading it. We hate these verses. They mess up our Sunday school theology. The very first chapter of Proverbs 1:22, God says, How long will you simple ones love your simple ways? How long will mockers delight in mockery and fools hate knowledge? If you had responded to my rebuke, I would have poured out my heart to you. I would have made my thoughts known to you. But since you rejected me when I called, and no one gave heed when I stretched out my hand, since you ignored all my advice and would not accept my rebuke in turn, I'm going to laugh at your disaster. I'm going to mock when calamity overtakes you. When calamity overtakes you like a storm, when disaster sweeps over you like a whirlwind, when distress and trouble overwhelm you. God goes, look, how long are you going to keep living your life your way? How long are you going to go by your wisdom and what you think's right? And this whole time I've been trying to tell you how to live life my way, and yet you refuse to listen. So the consequence is you're going to get into troubles, you're going to get into battles, you're going to get in jams, you're going to get into prison, you're going to get into slavery. And he says, you're going to call out. You're going to say, God, we have problems. And he goes, I'm going to mock your problems and go, they're your problems. They're not my problems. Let's see how well you do with your life, because it's your life. And right there's where Christians go. At that point, you just have to pray to God. If you get in a jam because you've been doing your life your way, you pray to God and he's supposed to fix it. There's the verses. 28. God says, I know that's what you think Sunday school works, but let me tell you how it really works. Then they will call to me and I will not answer. They're going to look for me, but they won't find me, since they hated knowledge and did not choose to fear the Lord. Since they would not accept my advice and be spurned by my rebuke, they will eat the fruit of their ways. They're going to be filled with the fruit of their schemes. For the waywardness of the simple is going to kill them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But, circle highlight on it, but whoever wants to really listen to me will live in safety and be at ease without fear of harm. And God says, if you want to live your life and expect there is a God that's going to answer your prayers, he goes, you're a fool. You're a fool. You go, but I've been crying out to God to fix the relationship. And God goes, it's not my relationship. But I've been telling God to fix my finances. And God goes, they've never been my finances. You really think they're your finances. Some of you have been praying for a job. You know why God doesn't answer? Because your job's never been his. Your workplace has never been his. So why does he care about your finances and your workplace? We got this idea of Christianity that God is here to be used by us. And we teach it. The way we use God is by prayers. We run to God. It's like a cosmic Coke machine. We take out our prayers. We put it in. We hit what we want. We're like, woohoo, see you, big G. And we go back to our life. And that's what Israel did. Israel wasn't in relationship with God. They just wanted to use God. And God goes, it's about to get worse. You're going to want your money back because you're playing religion. And religion stinks. What was Israel doing in the battle without God in the first place? And God says, let me start the book of wisdom in Proverbs and just tell you, if you want to live your life, you're allowed. But then you are also going to answer your own prayers to your problems. Because God says, it's not my problem. Don't expect to live your life. Call on God and God gives you a better life. God has no intention or desire to give us a better life. God wants to own our life. And we get so confused. And North Coast, when we stop chanting, God is worthy, and we start chanting, God is useful, then we know our ark has been stolen once again. They turn to religious magic. They turn to voodoo Christianity. I say the prayers, God jumps. God, I need this, chop, chop. We never say chop, chop to God. We say amen. Chop, chop. God, this is what I need. This is what I want. Chop, chop. And we get angry at God and we're resentful. And you know why we don't like Christianity? Because it doesn't work. And God's up there going, cry out louder. I don't know who you're praying to, but I ain't your God. You expect to live your life and have me answer your prayers? Oh, that's not Christianity. That's religious magic. And it doesn't work. Let me tell you how to get on God's side. Because God will never get on our side. Number one, I think the point of this story is simply remember that God would rather be with those who fear him than with those that want to use him. God would rather be with people that fear him than with those that want to use him. The Philistines don't even know who God is. They're just scared to death of him. The Christians just want to use God. And God goes, I'm going over here. At least these guys fear me. They don't even know my name, but they fear me. They tremble. You guys think you can throw me into your problems and have me save you? This one's going to hurt. Oh, honey, this one's going to hurt. But if this will awaken us to the type of God he wants to be, he says, then it's going to hurt. And Jacob goes, my years have been few. I look like I'm 195. Oh, they've been tough. But I've got something to bless Pharaoh with now. I found out who God is, and it's not me. Joseph understood it all along. Joseph didn't say, God, make me vice president. That's why I'm going to be a good slave. Joseph just said, God, it's your slavery. God, it's your imprisonment. God, it's your life. And God goes, I'll do something with that. Abraham had to leave home. He had to leave everything behind and say, God, I got to trust you. And God said, I'll do something with that. But never, ever think God is here to be used by you. That's not the story of Genesis. I think secondly, we have to understand that Jesus died to be our king, not our servant. Jesus died to be our king, not our servant. Oh, Christian, hear me on this. Those of you that are checking out Christianity, understand this. Jesus did not die on the cross to answer our prayers. He died on the cross to own us. And Jesus will never be a part of our lives. And I'm sorry if Sunday school told you that. Ours doesn't teach that. He will be all or nothing. He will be God or nothing. And you cannot say he's a part of my life and I have salvation if he's not Lord and God of our life. He died to be king, to buy us, to own us. Not to be a magic genie that if we rub him the right way in our prayers, he's got to come through for us. He goes, I don't play that game. Read the rest of the passage in chapter 7. It says, Israel has been crying out to God for 20 years. For 20 years, they've been crying out to God. And God goes, I'm not listening to my people. Because you're not my people. Chapters 2 and 3. The morality and sexuality inside the church was no different than the morality and sexuality outside the church. The amount of pornography use inside the church was no different than the pornography use outside the church. The character and ethics inside the church was no different than people outside the church. He says, besides where you go on the weekend, there's no difference from you. He goes, you're not my people. Therefore, your problems aren't my problems. Chop, chop. And for 20 years, they've been crying out. And the prophet Samuel finally says, are you done crying to God? Do you really want to be right with God? Chapter 7, 2 on. It's there in your notes. He says, get rid of all your Baal, your worship of success, and get rid of your Ashtoreth, your worship of sexuality. And follow God alone, and he'll be your God. But until then, keep praying. He's not listening. You see, lastly, instead of getting religious, we need to get right with God. And North Coast, I felt as one of your pastors, if we close this book with God makes everything better without saying, no, this isn't about getting God on our side. It's about us coming back to God's side. We would do an injustice to the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is following the life of people and say, life's been tough. And I finally said, God, it's your life, not mine. And God said, I'll do something in Egypt or I'll take you out of Egypt. But trust me either way. But this is not a book of religious magic. This is not a book of how to get God to answer your problems. And if that's how we treat God, I promise you, you're going to be tired, depressed, frustrated, resentful at God. Because he's not answering your prayers. Because God knows we've ordered him to. And he's refused to take our orders. That's a guy that says, no, I'll own you. I'll use you. I'll change you, but I'm not here to bless your life. I'm here to be God. Father, may we be a people that come to you and surrender all of us. Every action, every relationship, our finances, our speech, the way we get work, the way we lead people or the way we follow. God, may we be people that say all of us is yours. And then we know that you are a God. Then we know that we live according to your word, even in places where we don't like it. But God, may we never be a church and a group that feels like since we gave you an hour and a half on the weekend, you have to answer our commands. Oh God, forgive us for coming and making this religious voodoo, Christian magic. May we be people that surrender our ways to you and find you more than faithful. In Jesus' name, amen.
So before we close, if you want more information about this teaching or any other teaching, just go online. www.northcoastchurch.com, or you can come see us at 2405 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. Check the website for times of services. And now let's get back to some closing thoughts from Pastor Chris.
You know, as you go, I go back to that upper room, that last night of Jesus' freedom, that last supper where he's there with the disciples. He knows they're about to run away. He knows they're going to reject him. He knows one of them's got to betray him. He knows another one's going to come back and curse his name. And he still says, guys, famous last words. This is going to be ringing in your ears even when you run from me. He didn't say, here's how to use me. He didn't say, here's how to pray. He doesn't say, here's how to get God's power in your life. He says, I'm the vine, you're the branch. Apart from me, this doesn't work. It doesn't work. And he gave him 11 things to do. He said, I want you to remain. I want you to remain. I want you to remain, 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 and to remain. And he goes, look, before the guards come and take me away, your sole job is to remain. He wanted one word. He goes, otherwise this Christianity doesn't work. Otherwise, you're going to get out on your own and expect God to bless your life. And that's not why I came. I came to own you. You stay with me. Remain with me. And I will be your God. Outside of that, apart from me, you can do nothing. Oh, he got it. Famous last words. He hopes and prays that we get it. We got to pick it up from there next week. Until then, turn around. Greet somebody that's simply supposed to remain. We'll see you next week.